Our second conference today is moving, you know, beyond simply how do we relate to other human beings, to how do we as human beings relate to the physical environment around us, both living and non-living. So that day that I mentioned where I was walking on campus and all those people were sort of sucked into their own world, something very funny happened. Stefano, I don't know if you remember this, but at Purdue we have these sort of like dog-sized delivery robots that kind of roll around campus because you have them here in Nashville also? Yeah. That I've never done it before, but I imagine you order something on your phone from some store and it kind of rolls its way over to you, and every once in a while they get stuck and you know, a good Samaritan will sort of like put them on the right path, like flipping a turtle over. And that day, something happened that I had never seen before, which was some students were driving one of the campus golf carts for some organization, apparently somewhat recklessly, and actually collided with one of these things and took a wheel off of it, which I must admit I took a certain amount of perverse delight in, that we can show the machines who's really in charge. But in that moment, something amazing happened, which was that these sort of technological bubbles that all of these young people had sort of locked themselves into, everybody kind of looked, took their headphones off, and all of a sudden there was laughter. There was chatter. There was, oh, hey, I didn't know you were here. And that I think that might be a bit of a metaphor for what God is inviting us into. It might seem a little bit odd to sandwich a conference about technology between one on love of neighbor and another on love of God. There might be some of you right now who are thinking, when is Father gonna start actually like talking about God today instead of just society stuff? And I promise I'll get there. But if we're going to call ourselves Dominicans, our prayer cannot be divorced from our thought. That if we are to preach reality effectively, first we have to grasp reality effectively. We have to be able to see our world as it really is. I mentioned in the last conference about the risk in Catholicism of intellectualizing our faith, that reducing it to a list of propositions that we can adhere to, and that because we are Orthodox and because we fulfill the basic precepts of the Church, we avoid the things that the Church explicitly prohibits, that is enough. We forget just how radical God's vision of the good life that he is inviting us into. Once again, let's go back to Genesis and remember that even before the fall, God gave mankind dominion over all creation. That we were not simply one species among many, but instead hierarchy is part of the very fabric of reality. From the Godhead himself and the Trinity, all the different choirs of angels, from the, you know, the rocks and the plants and the animals, and then there's us, these strange creatures that are the hinge between the intellectual and the physical. We are called to act in hierarchy. Now, especially for us Americans, hierarchy is sometimes considered a dirty word. Right? It implies power, it implies domination, it implies disorder. Our whole system, right, is based around the idea, you know, developed over time, of course, that everybody gets a say, everybody gets a vote, everybody gets to ideally call the shots. And if some people get to call the shots more than others, and that's sort of it's a concession to practical realities. But the way God made it was not so. Hierarchy in creation simply means that individuals have different roles and that we exercise our different levels of authority in terms of mutual service. So you think in terms of a family, it's parents' job not to dominate or to use your children, but to actually call and help your children be better children. And that to be a good child is not to simply take as much from your parents as you possibly can, but to actually receive the formation that they've given you and contribute to the common life of the family as you are able, according to your ability. So it is with human beings. Now, when it comes to that realities which are beneath us, ontologically speaking, two main ways that we do this. The first is through things like agriculture, right? Where we take living beings, plants, animals, and we actually cultivate them so that they can flourish properly. Even in instances, right, where we actually use these creatures, we eat them or use them for leather, whatever the case is, that doesn't work if they're not healthy, if they are diseased, if we use them out of existence. One of the fun things about being in a place like Purdue is that we've got a big old ag school, agriculture school. And so I get to be around people that grew up on family farms, which in suburban Chicago where I grew up was not common practice. But I've learned a thing or two about raising cattle and such. And that there actually is, if we approach activities like this from a truly authentically Christian perspective, then what we realize is that we are allowing creatures that are lower to actually participate in the life of creatures that are higher. And if that sounds familiar, it's because what is Christianity, if not God who descended and became man, so that human beings might participate in his life? We don't have to apologize for using what has been given to us if we use it appropriately. The second main way in which we interact with material reality is through what in scholastic circles we might call the production of artifacts. That is, things that we make, right? Artificial things, which are, we would say, composites, because we put them together, but they're not in and of themselves substances, to use the Thomistic language. That they don't have a particular nature in the same way that you and I have a nature given to us by God, or that Fluffy the dog has a dog nature, right? That wasn't, like, you and I don't point to Fluffy and say, I'm going to decide what your nature is, in the same way that we decide to create a saw or a table or whatever the case is. But something amazing happens when human beings leave, or when we create artifacts, when we make those artifacts, is that we actually leave a mark of our own personhood, our own intelligence, on that inert matter, on that inanimate matter, so that it can then actually participate in our own life. We, in a sense, grant a higher degree of dignity to that iron ore, or to that wood, or to that stone, than it would have possessed simply on its own. That it can participate in the use and in the beautification of the universe. That's a rosy picture. Because the reality is, as the centuries have gone on, we recognize that the way that we use technology, and perhaps the way that we interact with things like agricultural technology, are sometimes healthy and sometimes not. There's a late social commentator, his name is Ivan Illich. I don't endorse everything that he ever said, but he has some really interesting thoughts in a lot of his books. And he coined this term of what he calls conviviality. And we can describe human life as convivial when human beings have, he says, autonomous and creative relationships among persons and between persons and their environment. In other words, what this means is that we human beings were created in the image and likeness of God. That we weren't simply made to be passive receivers of material reality or of wisdom, but that instead we are called to use our faculties in order to improve the world around us and to know and love our neighbor. And so whatever way that we are interacting with the material world, has to give pride of place to continuing to allow human beings to exercise their faculties in an active way. Unfortunately, as time has gone on, one of the dynamics that we've seen is that the way that human beings interact with technology becomes more and more passive. As the tools that we use get more and more complex, it requires greater specialization to design and maintain them. Anybody who's driven a car for longer than 15 years has observed this, right? There was a time when anybody and your neighbor could actually go under the hood, could pull out a wrench, and take a look at and maybe even fix what was going on in your car if you had the right parts. As technology's advanced, objectively speaking, in terms of the purpose for which the car was made, to get us from point A to point B, to not break down, to use right less gas rather than more, the tools are better. But the way that we interact with the tools has gotten worse. That now, instead of being able to look at something like my engine and actually be able to exercise some degree in expertise and creativity toward it, all I can do is be a consumer. I have to take it to the dealer so that it can do the proper diagnostic to tell me what is going on. And of course, it's not just vehicles. In many ways, what the kind of childbearing that once would have taken place in the home, or that's early childhood education or school-age education, now as the kind of jobs that we're preparing people for become more complex, we say, well, that has to occur outside the home. Or we say, as standards of healthcare get higher and people live longer, good things, the kind of care that once would have been done out of love for free is now generally paid for by CNAs in places like nursing homes. Though with the Industrial Revolution, one of the things that happened was that the home went from being a place of both production and consumption. You have the family farm, you have a trade, right, where you're making something. And meanwhile, the whole family is participating in that in some way, right? Men and women. Two, with industrialization, production moves into large-scale factories. And the home is reduced to being a place of consumption. This is one of the places where I will cite my source for obvious reasons. One of the better books I've read in a long time, her name is Leah Labresco Sargent. Maybe some of you have seen her. She's kind of a social commentator. And she just came out with a book in the last couple of months. It's called The Dignity of Dependence, A Feminist Manifesto. And she's digging into the ways in which modern life affects women in a particular way, in ways that, quite frankly, I had never thought about. I suppose that's very Dominican of me, is in order to learn what it's like to be a woman, I have to read a book about it. But she says what happens with industrialization is that women are faced with a dilemma. One is to stay home. And, you know, if you look back to, say, the 1950s and the degree of substance abuse that was present among housewives in those days and mental illness and things of that nature, being reduced to the role of a consumer caretaker, right? Especially as home technology advanced. Or, on the other hand, joining the workforce and being forced to conform to male standards of productivity. When women have on their bodies reminders of, say, their fertility and their difference from men at all times. And yet, despite the obvious dehumanizing drawbacks of post-industrial society, technology has a way of perpetuating itself. And maybe, again, this is particularly American, that if we're able to do this thing, if this technology exists, then it must be used, lest we fall behind. So I talked for a while about the automobile. The United States was unique in the industrialized world after the Second World War, in that we were not directly affected by the destruction of battle. And so since we were all of a sudden by far the most prosperous society in the world, we said, since everybody pretty soon will be able to afford a car, that is the new standard by which we measure somebody's participation in society. And so we were just talking a little bit ago, what happened to our parishes that were more than just places to go to mass? Where they were people getting to know one another, taking care of each other, knowing who was in need and who was doing better. Not to put too fine a point on it, but the car happened. The suburbs happened. That now, all of a sudden, how I get from point A to point B went from seeing, like having somebody else in front of me as I walk down the street is a blessing. I might meet somebody. I might know somebody. Now, if I'm getting from point A to point B and somebody else is doing the same thing, I don't call that a blessing. I call that traffic. It's funny how the things that we just take for granted. I mean, right? We don't live on campus, so I drive a car back and forth to the parish every day. I'm not saying we all have to get rid of our cars tomorrow. But I think we Dominicans do have to do some deep theological reflection on the things that our society takes for granted, that might not be explicitly prohibited in the catechism somewhere, but might nonetheless have a deep impact on the way that we human beings, and we Christians in particular, relate to one another. I made a point when I came down here. In the end, the amount of money that I would have spent on gas and the amount of money that I spent on my bus ticket would have been about the same, right? And I could have turned on a good podcast or something like that and just gotten in the car and drove. I made a point of taking the bus to get here. Not right, just because it's better for the environment, right? That's true. But because I think it's good for me to be in a situation, as we're talking about this morning, where I am around people that I did not choose to be around. I was around a lot more neck tattoos yesterday than I was at other points in my life. And I heard people talking about things to their significant others on their phone that I will not repeat. And while they're also bragging about how the fact that they're with a Catholic priest on the bus, like they knew I was there. But I think it's good for me to be in that environment. That if we constantly lean into what is the most technologically advanced way that I can solve a problem, then we wind up buffering ourselves off from the people around us, and quite frankly, from God, or at least from our ability to perceive God. And I actually become less human as a result. I look at our young people, particularly our university students, the entertainment that they have access to is so much more attractive than anything that existed before. Many of them no longer have a hobby, much less the ability to perform some trade. There's a big conversation right now about the idea of extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. In other words, why am I doing the thing that I'm doing? Am I doing it because it itself is good and noble, or am I doing it because I am getting some benefit out of it, financially or otherwise? Alistair McIntyre names certain things as practices, as kind of the technical term that he uses for them, are things that I can get better at, and I can evaluate it according to the logic of a particular community. So things like chess, the arts, sciences, even sports, as well as, physical traits, things like bricklaying. That these are ways, these are skills that I can develop that will actually make it so that my way of interacting with the environment is not purely as a consumer. Something else happened with the Industrial Revolution. And it was that for almost all of human history, even of those of us who are not necessarily farmers full-time, would have still had some connection with the land. It was inevitable. If they weren't your chickens, you knew the person whose chickens they were. And what happened, I think, is that even now, those who are, you know, talking a lot about things like care for creation, the reality is that dynamic is really reduced to something like managing a carbon footprint, which again, not a bad thing, but I think God is inviting us to something deeper. Since it is the feast day of our Holy Father, St. Francis, let's use him as an illustration. And if you've never read G.K. Chesterton's biographies of Thomas Aquinas and St. Francis, highly, highly recommend them. Not necessarily for their factual description of history, right? The scholarship has come a long way in the last 100 years. But because of the precise insights that he's able to name when it comes to who these people are and how they challenge the people of our age to look at things differently. Chesterton says this: St. Francis was not a lover of nature. Right, we think of him as sort of he was the guy that preached the birds and all these things. He says, no, St. Francis was not a lover of nature. Properly understood, a lover of nature was precisely what he was not. We talk about a man who cannot see the wood for the trees. St. Francis was a man who did not want to see the wood for the trees. He wanted to see each tree as a separate and almost a sacred thing. Being a child of God, and therefore a brother or sister of man. For the first time in my life, I've actually thought about getting into gardening. Father Steve is the friar I live with, who he grows tomatoes and peppers and herbs and all sorts of things. I was never taught how to do that. I never really gave it too much of a thought. What I've noticed in Father Steve is that he's able to pay attention to things in a different way than I am. I so often fall into the temptation to treat things as abstractions, as systems. How do we increase yield? How do we increase productivity? But when you're caring for a tomato plant, you're not caring for tomato plantness. Yeah, you need to know a thing about it, but you're actually looking at the thing in front of you. I think those of us who aren't in that situation are missing out, that we would benefit a lot from, as the youth say these days, touching grass. No, as a spiritual father, what keeps me up at night aren't so much the sins of commission, and you can imagine what those are. What keeps me up at night are more the sins of omission, that we have perhaps reduced living our Catholic faith to a kind of bland middle-class self-sufficiency, where we say all the right thing and fulfill all the obligations of the church. And that in the rest of our lives, we're simply passive. We're simply consumers. We are simply receiving whatever is put in front of us uncritically. A challenge that I've given to my college students is this: one, to get, try at least, to get good at something. But there are restrictions on this. One, you can't get good at something that somebody else is selling you. So a video game doesn't count. But also to get good at something that you're not selling to somebody else. In other words, get good at something that isn't going to wind up on your resume. And it's funny how much people can do mental gymnastics to think that they're really good people of the thing that's just going to get on the resume, right? What that does is that it busts us out of that transactional mode of existence that simply wants to manipulate the matter in front of me and optimize my time and energy so that I can receive as much stuff, as much entertainment as possible. Once again, I am far from the expert here. In fact, I think the reason that I've started paying attention to these things so much is because I am so sorely lacking in it. But I know that there are people in this room. I know we're full of bright Dominican laity who do have a few things to say about it. And so with that, I will take a pause. Once again, we'll take a moment just to be quiet, reflect, jot down any notes if you'd like. And then I'll call for questions or comments. Anybody like to, oh, sister, you have something to say? Okay. Good. In the back. Yeah. Stand and be loud.
Just curious, you touched this a little bit, and just curious about maybe a broader conversation around talking in the book, and thinking of independence. I'm curious about the particularly of independence, but dependence on God through things like, like money, and owning a, you know, planting of tomatoes, but putting part of the cane in your tomatoes. If that makes sense as a.
By engaging that process at different.
Instead of being a consumer, being a producer.
Right.
Instead of making a choice to produce directly.
Right.
Whether for yourself or for others.
Yeah. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly that, and sometimes just starting with something small, right? I'll put a tomato plant in my backyard. It's interesting, the pendulum is starting to swing the other way on some of these things. Like both when I was in St. Louis and now when I'm in Lafayette, Indiana, they've both passed chicken ordinances and different things that, to allow people to start to do some of this stuff, where once we say, no, that's dirty, we have to push that to the large-scale farms. I think sometimes we get an introduction to some of these things and then that introduces us to something else. So not just growing the plant, and allowing that plant to depend on me in that particular way, but then, okay, well, how do I make this last? How do I can it? And then how can I bless other people through the skills that I've developed? How can I teach these skills to other people? How can I meet other people through this process? Is going to make us way more human than spending another evening watching Netflix. Yeah. Sorry, in the back. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
My priest from the city doesn't buy chicken eggs. He gets the best, healthiest eggs in the city.
Yeah. And again, it's mutual gift and not transactional. Tell me your name again. I'm sorry.
Gary.
The church is a hierarchy, right? There is a sacred order to all of this. Not so that like priests and lay people can be pitted against each other, but so that Gary can take the wisdom that he has gained and the knowledge that he has and the stuff that he has, the land, the chickens, and say, how can I help Father live his life better and be a better priest? So that he doesn't have to, you know, spend, you know, his money or the church's money feeding himself, so that he can feel the love of one of his faithful, part of his flock that is caring for him. And in return, again, not as a this for that kind of transaction, but spontaneously out of the relationship, what does Father do for you? Well, he's given your life for the service to the parish and is going to do whatever he can to make sure that you receive the sacraments and the formation that you need to be a strong follower of Christ. So thank you for that example.
If I may add, our priest before Father Anthony Lopez, he's retired back to New Mexico, and he does priestly duties in this family parish there. But, I've been there now 7 years, returned back to the faith. And, I'm not bragging or anything.
Yeah. Thank you. And I hope in what I've been saying that you're not left with the impression that the point of all of this is to, well, we have to get this public policy that'll fix all of this. Or we have to insert this institution and that'll fix all of this. No, maybe the solution is give Father some eggs. You know? The small things. Built upon. We had a question here. Did you?
What are your thoughts
on AI? Oh, sure. My concern with AI, since that was the title of the day, wasn't it? It's funny how something will be in your mind, like as you start drafting something, and then it'll drop out by the end. My fear with AI is not like so much misinformation. Fine, fair enough. Or it's not so much like how are people going to use it maliciously. My concern is that it is yet another way in which we can take an activity, inquiry, which can be communal, and instead we've inserted a one-sided substitute for it. I mean, in kind of the same way that when I'm around somebody that knows something and I don't know it, but I'm too embarrassed to ask, I go on Google instead. Maybe you've done that before, right? This pursuit of knowledge together that can be taking place has instead again been me, something that I receive, once again from a machine that I do not fully understand, and am therefore not able to participate in terms of my creative faculty in the same way.